Welcome to the True Falls Film Festival.
Welcome to the True False podcast, presented by KBIA. I'm Allison Kofelt. This episode, we're discussing our True False Shorts programs. Last year, the Fest decided to do its Shorts programs a little differently. The programs, which usually last an hour, are now followed by a drink-centered reception with the filmmakers, rather than your standard on-stage Q&A. One filmmaker who has shown several shorts at the festival is Charlie Line, whose film Lasting Marks played at this year's Tequila 62 program. He sat down with True False podcast producer Sebastian Martinez Valdivia.
So the festival's shorts programs have always kind of incorporated films that you might see more in galleries, films that don't have traditional narrative structures at all, that are a lot more experimental. Is there anything that you think ties them together? Any way of conceptualizing the documentary short form?
Yeah, I mean, I think the only thing that ties them together, and perhaps the only thing that should be tying the films of this festival together, is a pursuit of nonfiction in some way. And I love that that is the sole kind of unifying factor, because you're right, like, this is work that most festivals, most documentary festivals, just ignore because they consider it to occupy a different space. And also because you have to go looking for it. Like, I know how hard the programmers work to go and find this work that the filmmakers probably aren't submitting because they don't think of it as work that exists within a documentary film festival space. Like you say, they, you know, they work in the gallery or they work at avant-garde festivals or whatever else. And yet when you see them together, you realize how kind of permeable these lines are that, you know, that separate, like, my film, which is a, you know, fairly narratively straightforward documentary that was commissioned by an online platform and will ultimately live online, with another film that has premiered in, you know, the Tate Gallery in London and will mainly play kind of experimental film festivals and then maybe never be released because it's been editioned or whatever else. And so it's often really hard to bring this work together, and I think it feels really kind of mutually rewarding when it is brought together. It opens, like, as a filmmaker, it opens my eyes to the possibilities of other ways of working and expressing, you know, nonfiction ideas.
Yeah, when they're put next to each other, I think that's a good point. You do start thinking about the form itself a little differently when you have that wide variety that you're seeing in one self-contained 60-minute program.
And hopefully you kind of question the received wisdoms of your own particular little, you know, niche. You know, for instance, my film is relatively, you know, visually unusual or unorthodox, but there's certainly, like, narrative beats in there that are quite familiar from a lot of documentaries. And the more you see work that eschews those beats, the more you kind of challenge yourself to think about the choices you're making. No, I loved it. It, you know, this really is like one of a vanishingly small number of film festivals that puts together shorts programs as thoughtfully as they do.
So, kind of related to that, do you think that there is more opportunity, or it's a little easier to be a little more experimental in terms of how you tell a story in a short versus in, like, a feature-length documentary?
Yeah, I think definitely. I mean, there obviously, when you're working with a smaller budget, as you almost always are with a short film, there are less kind of stakeholders in the sense of, you know, people worried about getting their money back or worried about how accessible the film may be or whatever else. And so I think you do have a little bit more leeway to experiment, which isn't to say that people don't get trapped in, you know, certain ways of thinking and that certain commissioners or platforms don't want you to be working in kind of one mode. But I think, you know, one of the things that's really hit home this year at True False as well is, both across shorts and features, how many fewer kind of very recurring tropes there have been. Like, I was suddenly thinking yesterday, like, I don't think I've seen a film this year with talking head interviews in it, which, you know, I'm sure even 10 years ago would have been very hard to avoid at a documentary film festival. But even the most mainstream of the films that are here are really kind of at least challenging the received wisdoms of things like that. You know, this is not to say there isn't ever a place for a nice sit-down talking head interview, but I've seen less that are just there because that's what happens in a documentary. And it's kind of incredible that at the same time, these films are only becoming more popular and more successful. And I think putting the lie to the idea that, you know, an audience needs that kind of hand-holding. Because, I mean, God, like, think about like the life that would await the kind of documentaries that True False played 10 years ago. Like, they were, barring one or two crossovers, it was very much stuff that was destined for a life of esoterica. Whereas now, you know, left and right, almost all of the films here, it feels like, have some sort of trajectory ahead of them, whether that's, you know, at the top end, like Netflix or Amazon or whatever, but also, you know, theatrical runs and the much kind of broader circuit that exists for these films now around the world. It feels like a really exciting time, both for the content and the prospects of these movies.
Do you think there's anything behind that? Do you think there's any particular reason why there's been that shift?
I mean, I think, like, you know, like, very obviously these platforms are not an uncomplicated good, but I do think platforms like Netflix, platforms like Amazon have very much changed people's expectations of a documentary. I think one of the best things about those platforms, especially Netflix, is that the documentaries are not kind of off in a corner somewhere, that you're confronted with them constantly, and that they're very much positioned as equally important and equally interesting to the fiction work. I mean, often in Netflix's case, it seems like they actually have an easier time getting people to watch the documentaries than the fiction projects that they produce. But I think that's just really gone a long way to, you know, to kind of centralizing documentary in people's minds, and people no longer think of it as a kind of, I suppose, chore at the worst end, or at least as a kind of difficult form.
Educational.
Yeah, exactly. Like, all of people's assumptions about what a documentary is and what why they would be watching one, I think, are shifting very rapidly. And also, these organizations seem less interested in flattening out all of the documentary work that they pick up or commission or whatever else, so that it all feels, you know, like another episode of the documentary show, which is kind of how it could kind of feel when you were more or less exclusively seeing documentaries that were trying to fit into, you know, a PBS slot, or, you know, in the UK, there's like one documentary slot on the BBC, and all of these films kind of fit themselves into certain confines to try and occupy it. Whereas when you can, you know, make a 25-minute film and see it picked up by Netflix, that does open a lot of possibilities up as to, you know, what a documentary can be and still be successful. That said, obviously, there are a lot of bad things about what Netflix is doing in the documentary industry, not least the fact that, you know, to be picked up as a 25-minute film by Netflix, you're probably going to need to have a fairly okay chance of winning an Oscar, which is still a certain kind of filmmaking and a certain kind of film. But no, I think, like, it feels like it's a very exciting, expansive time.
Coming up after the break, filmmaker Charlie Lyne talks about pacing in short films.
Unfortunately, you don't have that same kind of freedom afforded to, like, feature filmmakers, where basically anything between 70 minutes and 2 hours is uncontroversial.
But first, a word from our sponsors. Hey, listeners, it's Allison, letting you know that this episode of the True False podcast is brought to you by the University of Missouri. And that is, in fact, where we are sitting right now in the KBIA studios at the University of Missouri School of Journalism. We're here with Ryan Vermeulener, news director for KBIA and assistant professor of journalism, and he is going to tell us a little bit about the Missouri Method. Hey.
Hey, what's up?
Nothing. Just want to know about the Missouri Method. What is that?
So Anytime you ask a journalism professor here about that, they always use analogies for it. And one of my favorite ones that someone at the Missouri in the newspaper that operates the journalism school said
once was... Oh, you got a newspaper.
Yeah, we got a newspaper and a TV station, radio station. But this newspaper editor was like, it's kind of like you're an air traffic controller, but none of the pilots have their licenses. Because we cut students loose. We just let them go crazy in actual professional newsrooms. And when I go to public radio conferences and tell them that we have 70 to 100 journalism students working in our newsroom as reporters, anchors, show hosts, producing podcasts like this one you're listening
like
to right
one.
Now.
Yeah.
These people look at me like I'm crazy because they're like, you give that kind of control to people that you don't know if you can trust. And it's like, yeah, we do. And it's kind of like, you push the bird out of the nest, right? And yes, lots of them do fall flat on the ground, and that's fine, and that's part of it. And I'd rather them fall flat on the ground here than out in the world.
True.
But a lot of them fly, right? And they do. We've had students win national professional awards competing against professionals for stories that they've done here. Yeah, as students.
Yeah.
And they win all the student awards. They win, like, all the student awards, too. But even professional awards, Edward R. Murrow Awards, students have them on their resume before they leave here at the University of Missouri. It's crazy.
Welcome back to the True False podcast, presented by KBIA. I'm Allison Kofeld. Let's get back to our conversation with filmmaker Charlie Line and podcast producer Sebastian Martinez Valdivia. In addition to his shorts, Line has directed two feature-length documentaries, including his debut, Beyond Clueless. Here, he talks about the differences between features and short films when it comes to pacing.
I think it's a constant push and pull with the pacing of a short, because try as you might, most people working in short form filmmaking are aware of the changed prospects for the film when it enters a certain runtime as opposed to another. So, for instance, my film is like 14 minutes, 45 seconds or something like that, which is sort of, you know, people will tell you that's sort of like top end if you want to have like a good chance of it being played widely at festivals and so on, for obvious reasons that if you make a 35-minute film, that's going to take up most of a shorts program. Whereas if you make a 5-minute film, you can be snuck in quite easily. And so it's almost impossible to switch that part of your brain off while you're working on these things because, you know, you obviously want the work to be seen. And unfortunately, you don't have that same kind of freedom afforded to like feature filmmakers where basically anything between 70 minutes and 2 hours is uncontroversial. So if I'm like brutally honest with myself, I think my film probably would be better at like 16, 17 minutes. And I think I've probably subconsciously or otherwise tried to hem it down to 14 to make that more likely. That said, like, I'm also coming from a position of like making work for the internet and where these sorts of things seem to matter slightly more as opposed to like work that's made for a gallery or for an avant-garde festival where they seem much less concerned about runtime. But I think, you know, it does nonetheless, you know, that's to kind of spin it negatively, but there is also a real value in thinking about, you know, the constraint of a short runtime and where you're making the choice to leave air and where you're making the choice to cut. It becomes a much more kind of economical process than I suppose you're allowed in feature filmmaking. And so personally, I love watching shorts and I love kind of seeing how people use those runtimes. And I think at their best, they are structured and paced in a way that a feature could never be. You know, I've certainly made shorts, I don't know, I probably count this one, where to extend the mechanics of it to a feature would be almost unbearable. You know, I've made shorts that move very, very quickly. And I think if you moved that quickly for an hour and a half, you would just drive people insane. Likewise, the short that I have here is so kind of visually stark that I think you probably couldn't watch it for an hour and a half. So it does, you know, it gives you a lot of leeway to experiment both in pacing and in form.
You mentioned, you know, when you're thinking about the length, it's kind of like a parameter that you're setting. And with any kind of creative process, it's easy to get kind of overwhelmed with the amount of things that you could do or the directions that a project could go. And so when you have like a set parameter like that, how does that help you in terms of like conceptualizing an idea or like narrowing down what you want to do or what you want to create?
Yeah, I mean, I think like I think I've been fortunate in a way in that a lot of the projects I've made or sort of ideas I've wanted to explore in film have felt like they fairly organically fit into, you know, what we would think of as like standard short times or standard feature times. So I do sympathize with filmmakers who have these ideas that make absolute perfect sense at 47 minutes and have to then grapple with the, you know, prospects for a film like that. Yeah, it's strange. I mean, like in my experience, I always conceptualize short filmmaking as quick and imagine that I will, you know, because they're short. And so you think like, oh yeah, I could probably like turn that out in like 2 months, you know, from concept to delivery. And invariably, you know, in my experience, they sort of run on as long as features do, because I suppose the difference is that you become, you know, as precious about your 14 minutes as you would be about your 90. And so decision, you know, small cuts and small moments that in a feature would become relatively insignificant, in a short feel like they have this outsized impact. So I think I certainly relish the boundaries you can push in a short, because, you know, there's less kind of justification for people saying like, oh, I don't think an audience will follow you if you do that. And you're like, well, you know, they only have to follow for 14 minutes. Like, how bad can it be? So I think you do get a bit of a leeway in that way, but I'd like to say it's simpler, but I feel like my experiences have shown me the opposite. I'm quite looking forward to making another feature just because I feel like it will take the same amount of time and there's a lot more reward.
Is that something that you're actually planning on doing in the near future?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've never seen short filmmaking as like the stepping stone to feature filmmaking, which is certainly the way in the UK it is conceptualized. And until very recently, like every short film fund in the UK was either kind of explicitly aimed at like new and emerging filmmakers who were kind of not yet ready to make features, or like in the most like planned extremes, there were funds where literally you couldn't get a short film made unless you said that it was essentially like a promo for a feature. So in submitting your, you know, pitch for what your short would be, you had to also explain how it could be adapted into a feature film, which is just like an incredible way to completely flatten down an entire form of artistic expression into basically, you know, marketing. But I get it. You know, I get why that happens, obviously, because people do want to make features. And it's often really hard to make features. So shorts are a good way to kind of establish yourself. But yeah, no, to my mind, like I can't imagine myself ever stopping making shorts. But yeah, it happens that at the moment, like the ideas that are coming to me feel longer. I mean, we'll see. Maybe not. Maybe I won't have enough content to use a horrible industry buzzword.
You dropped this. Yeah,
I dropped the C word.
The documentary C word. Yeah, that's great. So I want to talk about video essays for a little bit, because you put out a list of your top video essays for 2018, and a couple of yours were specifically video essays that like live on YouTube. And I feel like that has been a platform that has seen like a proliferation of video essays. Do you think that, I mean, I don't want to cheapen video essays as saying that they're just this, but do you think that they can be a way in for people into like documentary shorts and even like longer documentary projects?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think I've had so many people discover my work, which exists primarily in the spaces of film festivals and streaming platforms and the, you know, the places where film with a capital F live. I've had so many people discover that work through developing a love of video essay on YouTube, watching like, you know, a video about some film put together by a YouTuber who's never appeared at a film festival.
Or a Mario Kart course.
Or yes, in one of the examples that was on my top 10 list, there's a guy called, I think he goes by Summoning Salt. And he makes these extremely comprehensive, quite like dry video essays that often run to like 45 minutes, detailing the history of a given video game's speedrunning community. So for anyone who doesn't know, speedrunning is attempting to complete a video game or some aspect of a video game in the fastest possible time. And there are millions of people on the internet competing to get these, you know, record times. And so he'll just walk you through like 10 years of the world record in, you know, Super Mario 64 or Metroid Prime or whatever else, in a way that is, you know, even as someone who doesn't really play video games, is completely hypnotic. And just to see someone's passion and enthusiasm and knowledge of something play out like that is such a kind of addictive form that I think, yeah, no wonder it's taken off in a huge way. And to kind of go back to what we were talking about people thinking they kind of know what works and what doesn't work on the internet, you need only look at some of these video essays that are like a 2-hour video essay about one course on a video game from 35 years ago, and it's got 10 million views. And you just think like, yeah, what's the point? Like, clearly there's no predicting what's going to work and what's not. And yeah, I mean, I think it's the responsibility of us as film, you know, watchers and appreciators and makers, as well as festivals, to incorporate this whole new world of you know, moving image work, however you want to categorize it. Because my suspicion is that, like, Summoning Salt, whoever that is, has no interest in playing at a film festival. It doesn't know what this film festival is, or perhaps any film festival. You know, he's already reaching millions of people online and having his work funded through Patreon or whatever else. He's completely outside of this system that, you know, in our kind of insular way, we think of as the only way. So yeah, I think True False is a really brilliant example of a festival that does try and bring people in who aren't familiar or particularly interested in the world of the network of film festivals. And that group of people, like, yeah, if you can get them. Because this is the mistake, I think, is that a lot of the time when there's an approach to those people from like a more traditional film community, it's done with the tone of like, you know, aren't you lucky? We're going to let you into our much more like prestigious world. And actually, I think that's completely back to front. Like, you know, we should be so lucky to have these people who've done it completely without the support of this system come in and, you know, share that knowledge and that experience and all of those facts about video game speedrunning histories.
Charlie Line is a nonfiction filmmaker whose film Lasting Marks screened at this year's True False. His previous films, Fish Story, Personal Truth, and Copycat, have screened at the Best in years past. Thanks to Sebastian Martinez Valdivia for producing this episode. Our music was created by Tim Pilcher using sounds from the True False Film Fest. I'm Allison Kofeld. Thanks for listening.